describes himself in part as a former atheist and political radical who is still a graduate of Yale University, where he received his PhD in 1981, and who is now an associate professor in the departments of government and philosophy at the University of Texas in Austin. He is also an author and speaker. The core of his work is bringing Christian insight to bear on ethics, politics, and he frequently speaks about conscience, moral virtue, natural law, and self-deception. He's written five scholarly works: The Resurrection of Nature, Politics and the Human Character, published by Cornell University Press; The Nearest Coast of Darkness, A Vindication of the Politics of Virtue; True Tolerance, Liberalism and the Necessity of Judgment; Written on the Heart, The Case for Natural Law; The Revenge of Conscience, Politics and the Fall of Man; and also just published the book, How to Stay Christian in College. It is truly a great honor and pleasure to present such a distinguished speaker, gracious enough to leave his now homeland of Austin, Texas, in the middle of January, and come here to speak on the topic, Written on the Heart, The Case for Natural Law. Our speaker tonight, Dr. J. Budziszewski. Thank you again.
I think you're taking away my talk there, too, aren't you?
Would you like your talk? All right, we'll... Sorry.
Can everyone hear me? Way in the back, too? Okay, great. I am glad to be here in Minnesota, and although he says I'm so gracious to come from Texas, the fact is that I lived in Wisconsin until I was 13 years of age. I pine for the change of seasons, and I wish I could take some of the snow back with me. I don't know how you feel about it, and I'm really glad to be here with you. In one of the ancient Greek tragedies, the heroine seeks to give her dead brother a proper burial, to do the right thing, you know. But she is forbidden by the king because her brother was an enemy of the state. The heroine, whose name is Antigone, replies to King Creon that there is another law higher than the state's, and that she will follow that one instead of his because it has divine authority. Not even the king may require anyone to violate it. Is there such a higher moral law? Or are the moral relativists right? That would seem to be the supreme cultural question. Unfortunately, our own wise men seem to be unable to make up their minds about it. The judges of the Nuremberg Tribunal, on the one hand, held that there is a higher moral law, because when the Nazis said, well, we were only following orders, the judges of the tribunal said, that's no excuse. But on the other hand, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who has probably had more influence on American jurisprudence in the 20th century than any other judge, said that there isn't a higher moral law, and that what we call law is nothing but, his own words, the majority vote of the nation that could lick all the others. And so it seems that our wise men contradict each other. Yes, there's a higher law. No, there's not a higher law. And at times, you know, they even try to have it both ways at once, making a sort of a higher law principle of the very idea that there are no higher law principles. We find a good example of this in the notorious, well, it's come to be called the mystery passage, in the Supreme Court case Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Now, that was from 1992, in the last century, you know, where the Supreme Court said, I quote, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." Listen to that again. Okay, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Now, taken at face value, language like that can justify doing anything that you please. It's true that I blew up the Oklahoma Federal Building, but, you know, I was defining my concept of existence. It's true that I raped my neighbor, but I was working out my concept of the meaning of the universe as I see it. It's true that I murdered my babies, but I was fulfilling my concept of the mystery of human life. Antigone's claim that the higher law has divine authority can easily be misunderstood. Because the Greeks didn't have a tradition of verbal revelation, nothing like a Bible. The mythical hero Deucalion had never climbed any Mount Sinai like Moses did. The god Zeus had never announced any Ten Commandments. So, although Antigone said that the law that she was speaking of had divine authority, she didn't mean that it was something that she'd learned by reading something like a Bible with moral rules in it. Nothing like that. Instead, she seemed to be speaking of principles that everyone with a normal mind knows. Rules that you can't not know. Because we have a conscience. She seems to be speaking of a law written on the heart. She seems to be speaking of what philosophers have come to call the natural law. Now, by contrast with the pagans, Jews and Christians do have a tradition of verbal revelation. We know this. Moses, it is said, did climb the mountain. God did announce the commandments. You might think, then, that Jews and Christians wouldn't have anything like a natural law tradition because they wouldn't need it. They've got the Bible. Interestingly, just the opposite is true. The idea, the tradition of a law written on the heart is far stronger and far more consistent among Jews, and especially among Christians, than it ever was among the pagans. In fact, the very phrase that I've used a couple of times, the law written on the heart, is actually a biblical phrase. It comes from the New Testament book of Romans. Orthodox Judaism doesn't actually call the natural law by the philosophical expression the natural law. It calls it the Noahide law because of a rabbinical legend that God had given certain general rules to all of the descendants of Noah. And that means all human beings, long before he made his special covenant with the descendants of Abraham. And in similar fashion, Christianity distinguishes between what Christian theologians call general revelation, which means truth from God that every human being in some way receives, and special revelation, which is found only in the Bible. Special revelation, according to Christian belief, tells how God proposes to solve the problem of human sin, but general revelation doesn't do that. General revelation, which is the same as natural law, makes us aware of God's existence and his moral requirements, so it doesn't tell you how to solve your sin problem, but it's because of it that you know you have a sin problem in the first place, if you follow me. Interestingly, still speaking of these faith traditions, special revelation, the Bible, even talks about general revelation, the natural law, although it doesn't use that phrase. For instance, it speaks of the testimony of conscience in Romans 2. It speaks of the sense of an unknown God in Acts 17. It speaks of the plainness of God's handiwork in Psalm 19 and in Romans 1. It speaks of the principle of the harvest, that what you reap you sow. That's a means of moral instruction to every human being. Wouldn't you agree? In Proverbs 1 and in Galatians 6. And it speaks of the plain message of the principles by which we're designed. The human emotional and spiritual and physical blueprint, you might say, in Romans 1. Now, as a matter of fact, one of the most important developments of the last half century is that Protestants and Roman Catholics are not only talking about these matters again, but talking about them with each other. There has even been a revival of something like natural law thinking among, certainly among Jewish thinkers. Rabbi David Novak, in his very interesting book, Judaism and Natural Law, but much more surprising, among modern secular thinkers. Sociologist James Q. Wilson, offers a very good example in his wide-ranging, very well worth reading book, The Moral Sentiments. Wilson proclaims the existence of cross-cultural moral universals. Now that's a mouthful, but cross-cultural just means that you find them in all times and places. Moral universals means that these are moral ideas that you find everywhere. He holds that although these aren't strictly speaking innate, they are developmentally inevitable. So the baby doesn't know these moral truths the instant he pops out of the womb, but by the time he reaches adulthood, you can bet he's going to. Now, although Wilson denies that these universals are laws, he doesn't like to use the phrase natural law when he's speaking about these moral universals, because natural law is law. He says these aren't laws. He prefers to describe them as mere sentiments. That means feelings, universal moral feelings. And yet, even Wilson can't help slipping over from time to time, more than just from time to time, he does it more than a dozen places in his book, into the vocabulary of laws, of rules, and of obligations. It seems that he cannot help himself. So you find a great increase of interest in natural law theory by various names among Protestant, Roman Catholic, Jewish, and even secular thinkers in our times. The natural law is unconsciously presupposed, even when it's consciously denied, by other modern secular thinkers too. Let me give you an example of this. When I say that it's a presupposition, I mean it's something that you would have to know in order for us to understand the other thing that you're talking about. All right? We can see this presupposition at work whenever we listen in on an ethical debate. I'll confine myself to just one example. Just about the most secular, quote-unquote, moral theory that I know is utilitarianism. Now, according to this ethical theory, utilitarianism, the morally right action, is the action that brings about the greatest possible total happiness. Total meaning, you see, utilitarians think that you can add up different people's happiness. So, you know, you do the act where if I add together your resulting happiness and your resulting happiness and your resulting happiness, I get the greatest sum total. All right? Secular arguments by people who think that secular utilitarianism is wrong, is mistaken, they often proceed like this. They show that the theory produces conclusions which violate some of our most deeply held moral intuitions. I'll give you an example of that. It isn't hard to imagine circumstances in which murdering an innocent man might make everybody else happier than they were before. Okay, the man was innocent of what he was accused of, but nobody liked him. Okay, he was a mean fellow. He'd done maybe lots of other bad things. Besides, people were so angry at him that when they finally strung him up, even though he didn't do what he was accused at, they all felt so much better about it afterward. You know, and so by adding up all of their happiness, even after subtracting his unhappiness, you come up with a higher sum total. Seeking the greatest possible total happiness, then utilitarianism would require us to murder the fellow. And so the critics of utilitarianism will use examples like this and say, you see how it violates such a deeply held intuition that we have, so utilitarianism must be wrong. Now, they don't follow the utilitarian recommendation because of this. Instead, they reject the utilitarian theory itself. Now, I don't have any problem with that argument. I think it's a good argument against utilitarianism. But what I want you to notice is that it stakes everything on this moral intuition about the heinousness of murder, doesn't it? Well, now, if there isn't any law written on the heart, where on earth did that intuition come from? That's what I mean when I say that if you listen closely, if you listen between the lines, the presupposition of a law written on the heart, of certain moral principles which we can't not know, can be heard even in secular ethical arguments. Now, I think those are pretty strong considerations, but despite all of that, the predominant tendency in our culture today, now I have spoken of a revival of natural law theory, but this is a revival which is still in a minority position, okay? This is still something that's going against the wind. The predominant tendency in our culture today, both in the university and out in the world, is to deny the law written on the heart. To say, no, there isn't any natural law. There aren't any moral principles which are both right for everyone and also at some level known to everyone. It isn't true. A great many arguments are mounted on behalf of this denial. I would suggest to you that the most conspicuous feature of these many arguments is their flimsiness. For instance, it's commonly said that there couldn't be a natural law, a universal, objectively true morality, not only right for everybody, but known to everybody at some level. Why? Because different cultures have completely different moral ideas. That's what we're told. Different cultures have completely different moral ideas. If there were a natural law, then all cultures would have the same moral ideas. Well, now, this argument is absurd because all moral cultures do not all have completely different moral ideas. This is a false anthropology. As C.S. Lewis once remarked, just try to find a culture which admires a man for running away in battle or for cheating on all of the people who have been kindest to him. Just try to find a culture in which behavior like that is regarded as an act of virtue rather than an act of vice. You might as well, he said, find a culture in which 2 and 2 make 5. Now, to be sure, in 1972, the anthropologist Colin Turnbull seemed to some people to have done just that. Many people thought that he had found the moral equivalent of a culture in which 2 and 2 made 5. What would that be? A culture in which there was no moral sense, no awareness of these moral principles that are supposedly known at some level to everyone, no conscience. Why? Because Dr. Turnbull claimed to have found a tribe, an East African tribe called the Ik, in which conscience seemed to be non-existent, and in fact, everyone exploited everyone else. Not even between parents and children, according to his descriptions and stories, did the Ik admit a bond. Parents exploited children. Children exploited parents. It went all the way up and down the line. Now, right away, all the relativists began citing the Ik to prove that there cannot be a law written on the heart. And, in fact, I remember back in the days when I was a nihilist, when I didn't believe that there was an objective difference between good and evil, between right and wrong, I remember reading about the Ik, and it was, I thought, supporting evidence. Well, the Ik proved nothing of the kind. Bernd Heine, who was a later anthropologist, whom I am told on good authority was more fluent in the tribal language than Turnbull was, did his own investigation. Anthropologists do this, you know. Later ethnographers go back and visit the same culture. And he reported in 1985, that's 13 years later, that the Ik were not at all the way Turnbull had described them. They actually had a strong sense of social solidarity and mutual moral obligation. It wasn't too hard to find out why Turnbull had been deceived. The Ik were suffering some great calamities, and they weren't living up to all of their own moral standards, as many of us sometimes are guilty of moral failures when we're really put to it, when we're sorely tempted, right? But that's different than saying you don't have a moral standard. Violating the moral law is different than not knowing that there is one. They acknowledge this. So that was a blunder. Indeed, the Ik affair is merely one of a series of anthropological blunders. You know, I pick up this coffee cup and then I don't drink it. Earlier in the century, Margaret Mead, I'll try not to do that thing that too many times. I should warn you, I usually try to remember to do this when I begin to speak. If I say something like, I have 3 examples to give to you and I hold up 4 fingers, ignore the fingers, all right? Well, you're talking to the sort of guy who stops when the light turns green and goes when it turns red. I was saying that the Ik affair is just one of a series of anthropological blunders. Earlier in this century, Margaret Mead became famous. She was eager to prove that morality, especially sexual morality, is completely relative to culture. And so she managed to convince herself and the millions who read her books that the Samoan culture that she had studied was a paradise of free love. It used to be called free love. Well, the actual fact, as explained later by another anthropologist, Derek Freeman, he was the fellow who blew the whistle. It was already, by the time that he wrote about it, an open secret among anthropologists, but he made it public. The fact was that the Samoans were ferocious defenders of female chastity, who regarded both premarital sex and adultery with horror. Some people say, well, maybe it was only after the missionaries got to them that they adopted those views. Not so. The difference after the missionaries got to them was that they stopped killing people for this. There is a lesson here. We should be just as skeptical of modern books that tell of countries where people don't know the moral law as we now are of those ancient books that tell of countries where people's heads grow out of their chests. Just another kind of traveler's tale. Everyone then knows the moral law, not necessarily every detail, but the foundational principles. Everyone knows the moral law, but now not everyone knows that he knows it. Not everyone knows that he knows it. There is a difference between knowing it and knowing that you know it. The idea here would be, for instance, that the moral relativist is not a person who doesn't know the moral law. You steal his car and he'll be morally indignant. But he's a person who thinks he doesn't know the moral law. Knowing that we know the moral law is a clear point of superiority, then, I would suggest, in the natural law tradition. Many ethical theories, I think, go about matters backwards. They assume that the problem of human evil, of human wrongdoing, of human sin, if you like the term, has to do mostly with the state of our knowledge. In other words, they say, you know, it's so hard to tell. We don't know what's right and wrong. We're trying our best to find out, and sometimes just do the wrong thing. Well, the natural law tradition assumes that's not the way it is. The problem of human wrongdoing has mostly to do not with the state of our knowledge, but with the state of our will. In other words, it says that by and large, we do know what's right and wrong, but we wish we didn't. And that we are trying our best to pretend that we don't. We are so good at hiding our own knowledge from ourselves that there is no philosophical method at all which can infallibly disentangle the text on the heart of man from the evasions and subterfuges of men. The most brilliant short analysis of denial that I found anywhere in philosophy or in social science or in theology is actually due to the medieval Christian natural law thinker Thomas Aquinas. It was a long time ago. His question is, it wasn't, of course, his only question, but the one that interests me at present, is can human reason be twisted, perverted, so that the natural law is blotted out of the heart? I described the basic principles of the natural law earlier as principles that you can't not know, right? Are there ever circumstances under which you can not know them? That's what he asked. Well, now, according to Thomas, we have to make a distinction. It's annoying, you know, you go to a philosopher and the first thing that you hear is, we have to make a distinction. But there are times when we do have to split hairs. He says, there are on the one hand the secondary principles of right and wrong, the more detailed ones. And there are on the other hand the basic principles of right and wrong. So we really have to ask this question twice. Is it possible not to know the secondary principles, and is it possible not to know the basic ones? Okay? Thomas forthrightly admits that the secondary principles of right and wrong can be blotted out of the heart. He says, yes, they can. They can be clean forgotten, either temporarily or permanently. And he even mentions five ways in which such twisting of human reason, such perversion of reason, such blotting out of this knowledge can occur. I'll tell you what they are. First, he says reason can be perverted by passion, by strong emotion. Here's an example. I know that the person who tells me something, tells me bad news, is not the one who's guilty of the thing that's gone wrong. I know the difference. But momentarily blinded by grief and rage, I unjustly strike the bearer of the bad news that my wife is deep in adultery with another man. Reason perverted by passion. Number two, reason can be corrupt, can be perverted by corrupt habit. An example would be that little by little I get into the habit of using pornography or of cutting corners on my taxes or of cheating my customers in these little ways. At first my conscience bothers me, but I get used to it. I habituate myself and eventually I can see nothing wrong with my behavior. Number three, reason can be perverted by, let's call it, a congenitally impaired disposition. I mean, there's something wrong with your makeup, okay? An example would be that because of a defect in one of my chromosomes, I suffer a genetic predisposition to excessive violence or to alcoholism. Now, whether there are such genetic behavioral dispositions is rather controversial. I gather from the literature that the evidence for a genetic predisposition to alcoholism is considered fairly good. For a genetic predisposition to violence, loss of control and temper is not so good, but maybe. The evidence for a genetic predisposition to homosexual attraction is really not there, although it's been pumped up. So, you know, these are still matters of controversy, and a lot of evidence is still to come in. But let's suppose that there is some such congenitally impaired disposition. This would be another thing which could expose you to a rather constant source of temptation. You have a problem regulating your emotions and your desires, and so it may interfere with your processes of moral judgment, of moral reason. In a case like this, you would still be capable of restraint, but it might be more difficult for you than it might be for somebody else. Number four, reason can be perverted by vicious custom. Vicious here in the old-fashioned sense. Root word, vice, opposite of virtue. As when, let's say, having grown up among people who don't regard bribery as wrong, I take it for granted. I don't notice that it's theft. Finally, number five, we come to the method on which skeptical university folk, like me, depend the most, members of the chattering classes. Reason can be perverted by depraved ideology. As when, justifying my behavior on the theory that I'm merely exploiting the exploiters, I hotwire the telephone to make free long-distance calls on a line that I'm supposed to be paying for. One of the first things that I learned when I went to college was how to do that. Actually, the method that I was taught worked only for local calls, but it was still pretty nifty. It destroyed the telephone after you did this enough times. And the telephone company eventually caught on and you can't do it anymore. They're built differently. And this is exactly what we would say. This was a time when leftist political ideology was very big and we said this isn't theft because we're exploiting the exploiters. We're stealing from the stealers. We were like Robin Hood, you see. So what... we were the poor. So what Thomas is teaching us here is that learning clever theories doesn't necessarily make us better people. It may just teach us more sophisticated ways to deceive ourselves. So much for the secondary principles of right and wrong. We can lose them. We can not know them. They can be blotted out of the heart. But what about those basic precepts? Can they also be blotted out of the human heart? Not in the ordinary sense, no. These are the ones that I was really referring to earlier when I said the natural laws, the principles we can't not know. These make up the deep structure of our minds. They can't be forgotten. But now get this. They can be willfully misapplied. Consider, for example, the rule, thou shalt not murder. Or if you prefer the wordier version, you must never directly and deliberately take innocent human life. And that wordier version is actually convenient for the illustration that I want to develop now. Listen to it again. You must never deliberately take innocent human life. That's what we understand murder to be, right? That rule is one of the basics. I can't forget it and still be human. But I can rationalize. I can say, I must never take innocent human life. I can say, yes, but the bastard I killed wasn't innocent. He took the job that should have gone to me. In the same way, I should never take innocent human life. I can tell myself that the unborn child that I told the technician to cut to pieces wasn't human. I should never take innocent human life. I can tell myself that the grandfather whom I pressured into suicide didn't really have a life. Don't we do these things? Don't we tell ourselves these things? One of the most amazing events of our century is the rise, in fact, of entire intellectual and political movements devoted to the rationalization and the promotion of particular, am I allowed to use this word in Borger's books, sins. It isn't hard to see in some of these movements a vast, collective exercise in denial, a politically organized movement of self-deception, an effort to expunge some burning guilt, not by repenting and throwing ourselves upon the mercy of God, but by getting others to commit the same guilty deed. Consciously, the activists deny that they've broken the natural law. Consciously, they may even deny that there is a natural law, but unconsciously, they know they have, and they seek absolution in politics. Now, unfortunately, the condition of human beings since before recorded history is that we don't want to learn the truth about ourselves. We would really rather remain in denial. We would really rather mire ourselves in self-deception, which raises the last question of all, what power can break through such a barrier? My reply would be the only power that ever has. We can't write anything new upon the human heart. But we don't have to. All we really need is the grace of God to see what's already there. We don't want to read the letters because they burn. But they do burn, so at last we must read them. Thank you.